There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along on this Tuesday. Live local talk over the hour. And, you know, I had a lot of things planned out for today's show. Not to worry. We'll try to get to those in the second half of the show, second hour of the show. But it was slated as a hearing here between, a hearing with William Barr, Attorney General of the United States, and the House Judiciary Committee to talk about the sentencing of Roger Stone. Now, this has gone to a lot of places other than that in today's questioning, and it's been going on for a couple hours. I want to do this. Because if you were doing whatever, being a butcher, baker, candlestick maker, and did not catch the beginning of this, we're going to set this up, even though it's still going on. We're going to go back to the beginning here of today's hearing. And, of course, we mentioned earlier that it was Nadler, the House Judiciary Chairman Nadler, that was in the car accident this morning, delayed the start of this hearing, but he got in, and when he got in, it got busy. So let's do this. We'll start this hour off. We're going to work through this hour with we'll hear from Nadler, then we'll also hear from House Judiciary Ranking Member Jim Jordan, and then Attorney General William Barr. So let's do this. Let's go with cut one here. House Judiciary Chairman Nadler, his opening statements.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Barr. According to the Congressional Research Service, this is the first time you have appeared before the House Judiciary Committee, both during your first tenure as Attorney General 30 years ago and during your current service in the Trump administration. Welcome. 150 years ago, last month, in the aftermath of the Civil War, Congress created the Department of Justice. We did so with two missions in mind. First, we wanted to replace a system of party spoils with a core of professional government attorneys. Yes, these attorneys would be supervised by the Attorney General. And yes, the Attorney General would remain a political appointee. But at its heart, the department would rely on a foundation of professionals dedicated to the impartial administration of the law and an unbiased system of justice. Second, Congress established the Department of Justice to enforce the nation's first civil rights laws after the Civil War. From that moment on, it became the department's responsibility to ensure the right to vote and to stem the tide of systemic racism. Now, not every attorney general in the intervening 150 years has given full expression to these two goals. I am certain that every administration has fallen short of those promises in some way over time. But today, under your leadership, sir, these two objectives are more at risk than at any time in modern history. Your tenure has been marked by a persistent war against the department's professional core in an apparent attempt to secure favors for the president. Others have lost sight of the importance of civil rights laws. But now we see the full force of the federal government brought to bear against citizens demonstrating for the advancement of their own civil rights. There is no precedent for the Department of Justice to actively seek out conflict with American citizens under such flimsy pretext or for such petty purposes. 150 years later, we are again at a pivotal moment in our nation's history, Mr. Barr. We are confronted with a global pandemic that has killed 150,000 Americans and infected more than 16 million worldwide. We are coming to grips with a civil rights struggle long swept under the rug, if not outright ignored, by our government. We are, as a nation, witnessing the federal government turn violently on its own people. And although responsibility for the government's failure to protect the health, safety, and constitutional rights of the American people belongs squarely to President Trump, he could not have done this alone. He needed help. And after he finished utterly humiliating his first attorney general, he found you. In your time at the department, you have aided and abetted the worst failings of the president. Let us recount just some of the decisions that have left us deeply concerned about the Department of Justice. First, under your leadership, the department has endangered Americans and violated their constitutional rights by flooding federal law enforcement into the streets of American cities against the wishes of the state and local leaders of those cities to forcefully and unconstitutionally suppress dissent. Second, at your direction, department officials have downplayed the effects of systemic racism and abandoned the victims of police brutality, refused to hold abusive police departments accountable for their actions, and expressed open hostility to the Black Lives Matter movement. Third, in coordination with the White House, the department has spread disinformation about voter fraud, failed to enforce voting rights laws, and attempted to change the census rules to flaunt the plain text of the Constitution, and even defied court orders on this subject, all in the apparent attempt to assist the president's reelection. Fourth, at the president's request, the department has amplified the president's conspiracy theories and shielded him from responsibility by blatantly misrepresenting the Mueller report and failing to hold foreign actors accountable for their attacks on our elections, undermining both national security and the department's professional staff in the process. Fifth, again and again, you personally have interfered with ongoing criminal investigations to protect the president and his allies from the consequences of their actions. When career investigators and prosecutors resisted these brazen, unprecedented actions, you replaced them with less qualified staff who appeared to be singularly beholden to you. The message these actions send is clear. In this Justice Department, the president's enemies will be punished and his friends will be protected, no matter the cost, no matter the cost to liberty, no matter the cost to justice. Finally, and perhaps most perniciously, the department has placed the president's political needs over the public health by challenging stay-at-home orders in the states hit hardest by the pandemic. The department's persistent efforts to gut the Affordable Care Act will make recovery that much harder. These actions come at a price: real damage to our democratic norms, the erosion of the separation of powers, and a loss of faith in the equal administration of justice. In the hands of President Trump, a Department of Justice that adopts a dangerously expansive view of executive power and demonstrates a willingness to shield him from accountability represents a direct threat to the liberty and safety of the country. And we were warned. At your confirmation hearing, Professor Neil Kinkoff testified, and I quote, "Public confidence in the rule of law depends on there being an attorney general who will not allow the president to do whatever he wants with the Justice Department. William Barr's views of presidential power are so radically mistaken that he is simply the wrong man at the wrong time to be attorney general of the United States," close quote. Again, this failure of leadership comes at great cost. This administration has twisted the Department of Justice into a shadow of its former self, capable of serving most Americans only after it has first served those in power. This committee has a responsibility to protect Americans from that kind of corruption, Mr. Barr. We have a responsibility to ensure that the Justice Department and its Attorney General administer justice equally and fairly. And this is what has brought us to this hearing room today. We want to give you a chance to respond to our questions to these and other matters, and we hope and expect that you will do so in a clear and forthright manner. Our members expect sincere answers today, and our country deserves no less.
Well, I'm not sure if that was an opening statement or an airing of the grievances from House Judiciary Chairman Nadler. But when we come back, batter up Jim Jordan, House Judiciary Ranking Member, with some of the opening statements from his side of the aisle. Be right back.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Continuing with the opening of the hearing today for Attorney General Barr. They're still talking, but a lot that is being discussed now came out in the opening statements here. So we had the opening statement just a second ago from Nadler. Now we move on to the House Judiciary Ranking Member Jim Jordan. Let's go to that cut right now.
I now recognize the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, the gentleman from Ohio, Mr. Jordan, for his opening statement.
Spying. That one word. That's why they're after you, Mr. Attorney General. 15 months ago, April 10th, 2019, in a Senate hearing, you said this sentence, quote, "I think spying on a political campaign is a big deal." Spying on a political campaign is a big deal. It sure is. And since that day, when you had the courage to state the truth, they attack you. They've been attacking you ever since, every day, every week, for simply stating the truth that the Obama-Biden administration spied on the Trump campaign. 1 year ago, New York Times headline said this, 1 year ago, quote, "FBI sent investigator posing as assistant to meet with Trump aide in 2016. The FBI sent a young lady who used the name Azra Turk to meet Papadopoulos in September of 2016. They sent someone pretending to be someone else to meet a person associated with the Trump campaign. You know what they call that? You know what they call that? Spying. 1 month later, October 2016, they used the dossier to spy on Carter Page. The salacious, unverified dossier, Jim Comey's words, not mine. They took it to the FISA court, didn't tell the courts that the Clintons paid for it, didn't tell the court that the guy who wrote the document, Christopher Steele, had already communicated to the Justice Department that he was, quote, desperate to stop Trump from getting elected. And guess what? There were 15 more lies that they told the court. 17 in total. They're outlined by the Inspector General, each and every one of them in his 400-page report. But guess what? Chairman Nadler refuses to allow Mr. Horowitz to come here and testify and answer our questions about the 17 lies the Obama-Biden administration told to the secret court. The Obama-Biden DOJ opened the investigation in July. They used a secret agent lady to spy on Papadopoulos in August. They lied to the FISA court in September. And they did all this without any basis for launching the investigation to begin with. How do we know that? How do we know there was no basis? They told us. Now, they didn't want to tell us, but thanks to Rick Grenell, who released the transcripts of their testimony, we now know there was no basis for them to start the investigation in the first place. Sally Yates, Rhodes, Samantha Power, Susan Rice. Here's what Susan Rice says. "I don't recall intelligence I would consider evidence of a conspiracy." How about James Clapper? "I never saw any direct evidence that the Trump campaign or someone in it was conspiring with the Russians to meddle with the election." Say that again. "I never saw evidence that the Trump campaign was conspiring, and yet they investigate him. There was never a proper predicate. So why'd they do it? There was no reason to do it. Why'd they do it?" They told us that too. Peter Strzok, August 2016, asked, "Is Trump going to win? What's his response?" Remember, this is Peter Strzok. This is the guy who ran the investigation. "No, no, he's not. We'll stop it." August, Peter Strzok says, "We'll stop Trump." September, they spy on Papadopoulos. October, they use the fake dossier to lie to the court. But guess what happens in November? Guess what happens in November? November 8th, 2016, the American people get in their way. 63 million of them, to be exact. Now everything changes. Now the real focus is, wow, wait a minute. We didn't stop him. He won. Now what do they have to do? They have to do the cover-up. And who do they have to go after? Who's target number one in their cover-up? The former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the guy who's about to become national security advisor to the President of the United States, Michael Flynn. They can't have him hanging around. because he'll figure it out. So they decide to go after Michael Flynn. Three-star general, served our country for over three decades. And we know they went after him because they told us that too. Bill Priestep, head of counterintelligence at the FBI, the day they interview Flynn, January 24, 2017, his notes say what? What's our goal? To get Flynn to lie so we can prosecute him or to get him fired? Think about what the Obama, Biden, DOJ, what their administration did in the last month. The last month they were in power. January 4th, the agents investigating Flynn want to drop the case. Comey tells them no. January 5th, they have the now famous meeting in the Oval Office. Obama, Biden, Rice, Comey, all of them are in there. They're plotting their strategy, how they're going to get Flynn. January 6th, Comey goes up to Trump Tower, briefs President-elect Trump on the dossier that they already know is false, just so they can leak it to the press and the press will write the story that they briefed the president on the dossier. And then, of course, January 24th, the day they go set up Michael Flynn in his interview. Guess what else they did? Guess what else they did between Election Day and Inauguration Day? That two-month time, guess what else they did? 38 people, 49 times unmasked Michael Flynn's name. Comey, Clapper, Brennan, Biden, seven people at the Treasury Department unmasked Michael Flynn's name, for goodness sake. And of course, Flynn resigns on February 13th. Flynn resigns on February 13th. Now the cover-up is complete. Flynn's gone. Everything's fine, they think, until May 9th, 2017, when President Trump fires Jim Comey. Now they got a problem again. The guy who was going to keep it all quiet, he's been fired. Now, how do they continue the cover-up? Real simple. Jim Comey leaks his memos with the express purpose of getting a special counsel appointed to investigate something they already know is not true. And that's exactly what happened. We get 2 years, 19 lawyers, 40 agents, 500 witnesses, 2,800 subpoenas, and a $30 million cost to the taxpayer, and they come back with nothing. Absolutely nothing. And so all they got left is to attack the attorney general, who had the courage to state the truth right from the get-go, the first time he testifies after he's confirmed. You guys attack him every day, every week, and now you filed articles of impeachment against him. It's ridiculous. He had the courage to do what no one else would do at the Justice Department. Sally Yates wouldn't call it spying. Jeff Sessions wouldn't do it. Rod Rosenstein wouldn't do it. Chris Ray sure as heck isn't going to do it. So, Mr. Attorney General, I want to thank you for having the courage to call it what it was, spying. I want to thank you for having the courage to say we're going to get the politics out of the Department of Justice that was there in the previous administration. And maybe most importantly, we're going to talk about this in our side on questioning. I want to thank you for defending law enforcement, for pointing out what a crazy idea this defund the police policy, whatever you want to call it, is, and standing up for the rule of law. And frankly, we have a video we want to show that gets right to this point. Can we play that video, please?
I want to be clear in how I characterize this. This is mostly a protest. It is not, generally speaking, unruly.
Peaceful protest.
Peaceful protesters.
Peaceful protest.
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 Peaceful protesters.
On behalf of myself, my children, and the family of David Dorn, we'd like to thank friends, neighbors, co-workers, and the community for showing all the love and support we've suffered through the tragic loss of my husband, my beloved husband, David Dorn. We'd also like to thank St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department for their hard work and perseverance through this investigation, as well as Circuit Attorney's Office. He dedicated his life to the city of St. Louis, retiring at the rank of captain after 38 years of distinguishable service. Then as the chief of Moline Acres for almost 6 years. During those years, he's touched so many lives as a friend, mentor, co-worker, and guardian. His life was senselessly taken from me, from us, by an opportunist who had no regards for human life or the law. This didn't have to happen, but it must have been God's plan for David. We need to come together as a community and do better. We need to teach our young people that life is very precious. We as a family are going to be taking some time to focus our attention on healing, which is very important as we move forward. We would like David's legacy to be remembered as a loving husband, father, grandfather, brother, uncle, friend, colleague, and most importantly, a child of God. I want to thank you all for coming, and God bless you.
All right, that, of course, the widow of David Dorn, the St. Louis police captain, that was killed in these peaceful protests, right? And that it started some explosion. We'll run to the break here. We come back so we have time to get the comments from Attorney General William Barr as an opener. But what you couldn't see there was a montage of clips there of the rioting, of the lawlessness across the country, as yet. Yeah, news folks and government people saying, "Oh, well, these are peaceful protests out there." And then, of course, the widow of St. Louis Police Captain David Dorn speaking there at the end of it. All right, like I said, there's so much to this. It was going to be about the Roger Stone sentencing, but that is just one part of what's happening today in Washington with Attorney General William Barr getting questioned in the House Judiciary Committee. We'll be right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile on this Tuesday. And got a lot to do coming up next hour. Move some things around because his testimony today has been something. It was lined out as House Judiciary Committee hearing William Barr's testimony on the Roger Stone sentencing. That's been some part of it, but it has not. It has gone a lot of different places here, and we're just setting it up for you so you hear the opening statements and the stuff. This testimony could be going on by the time. By the time you get home this evening, it may still be going on the way it's set. Coming up next hour, State Senator Chris Elliott's going to join us. We'll talk about the passing of a political name and just a local name here, Robert Eddington, he passed away here within the last few days. And we'll talk about his legacy and a couple other things in state politics with State Senator Chris Elliott. Plus, coming up at the top of next hour, we'll discuss a couple things we were talking about this morning, as we'll be joined by a representative from President Trump's campaign to talk more about what's happening here. As I, 99 days or so out from Election Day. So we'll have a representative from the president's campaign joining us to talk more about that. Katrina Pearson, senior advisor for the Trump campaign, joins us a little after 1 o'clock. So that's coming up. All right, let's get back to it and statements here. This is now we've heard from Nadler. Now we've heard from Jim Jordan, and now the star of the show, Attorney General William Barr's opening statement. Let's go to that.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Jordan. I'm pleased to be here this morning. On behalf of the Department of Justice, I want to pay my respects to your colleague, Congressman John Lewis, an indomitable champion of civil rights and the rule of law. I think it is especially important to remember today that he pursued his cause passionately and successfully with unwavering commitment to nonviolence. As I said in my confirmation hearing, the Attorney General has a unique obligation. He holds in trust the fair and impartial administration of justice. He must ensure that there is one standard of justice that applies to everyone equally, and that criminal cases are handled even-handedly based on the law and the facts and without regard to political or personal considerations. And I can tell you that I've handled criminal matters that have come to me for decision in this way. The president has not attempted to interfere in these decisions. On the contrary, he has told me from the start that he expects me to exercise my independent judgment to make whatever call I think is right, and that is precisely what I've done. Indeed, it's precisely because I feel complete freedom to do what I think is right that induced me to serve once again as Attorney General. As you just said, Mr. Chairman, I served as Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush, And after that, I spent many years in the corporate world. I'm almost 70 years old. I was almost 70 years old and slipping happily into retirement. I had nothing to prove, and I had no desire to return to government. I had no prior relationship with President Trump. Let me turn briefly to the several pressing issues of the day. The horrible killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis understandably jarred the whole country and forced us to reflect on longstanding issues in the nation. Those issues obviously relate to the relationship between law enforcement and the African American community. Given our history, it's understandable that among Black Americans, there's at least some ambivalence and often distrust toward the police. Until just last 50 years ago or so, our laws were institutions were explicitly racist, explicitly discriminatory. It was not until the 60s that the civil rights movement finally succeeded in tearing down the Jim Crow edifice. Our laws finally came to formally embody the guarantee of equal protection. And since then, the work of securing civil rights has rightly focused on reforming institutions to ensure they better conform to our laws and to our aspirations. That work, it's important to acknowledge, has been increasingly successful. Police forces today are far more diverse than they've ever been. And there are both more Black police chiefs and more Black officers in the ranks. Although the death of George Floyd at the hands of the police was a shocking event, the fact is that these events are fortunately quite rare. According to statistics compiled by the Washington Post, the number of unarmed Black men killed by police so far this year is 8. The number of unarmed white men killed by police over the same period of time is 11. And the overall numbers of police shootings have been decreasing. Nevertheless, every instance of excessive force is unacceptable and must be addressed appropriately through legal process, as is happening now in Minneapolis. But apart from the numbers, I think these events strike a deep chord in the Black community because they are perceived as manifestations of a deeper, lingering concern that in encounters with police, Blacks will not be treated even-handedly. They will not be given the benefit of the doubt. They will be treated with greater suspicion. Senator Tim Scott has recounted the numerous times he's been unjustifiably pulled over on Capitol Hill. And as one prominent Black professional in Washington said to me, African Americans often feel treated as suspects first and citizens second. And I think these concerns are legitimate. At the same time, I think it would be an oversimplification to treat the problem as rooted in some deep-seated racism generally infecting our police departments. It seems far more likely that the problem stems from a complex mix of factors which can be addressed with focused attention over time. And we in law enforcement must be conscious of the concerns and ensure that we do not have two systems of justice. Unfortunately, some have chosen to respond to George Floyd's death in a far less productive way by demonizing the police, promoting slogans like "all cops are bastard," and making grossly irresponsible proposals to defund the police. The demonization of the police is not only unfair and inconsistent with principles of all people should be treated as individuals, but gravely injurious to the inner city communities. When communities turn on and pillory the police, officers naturally become more risk averse and crime rates soar. Unfortunately, we are seeing that now in many of our cities. The threat to Black lives posed by crime on the streets is massively greater than any threat posed by police misconduct. The leading cause of death for young Black males is homicide. Every year, approximately 7,500 Black Americans are victims of homicide. The vast majority of them, around 90%, are killed by other Blacks, mainly by gunfire. Each of those lives matter. It is for this reason that in selected cities where there has been an upsurge in violent crime, we are stepping up and bolstering the activities of our joint anti-crime task forces. Finally, I want to address a different breakdown in the rule of law that we've witnessed over the past 2 months. In the wake of George Floyd's death, violent rioters and anarchists have hijacked legitimate protests to wreak senseless havoc and destruction on innocent victims.
The current situation in Portland is a telling example. Every night for the past 2 months, a mob of hundreds of rioters have laid siege to the federal courthouse and other nearby federal property. The rioters have come equipped for fight, armed with powerful slingshots, tasers, sledgehammers, saws, knives, rifles, and explosive devices. Inside the courthouse are a relatively small number of federal law enforcement personnel charged with a defensive mission to protect the courthouse. What unfolds nightly around the courthouse cannot reasonably be called protest. It is, by any objective measure, an assault on the government of the United States. As elected officials of the federal government, every member of this committee, regardless of your political views or your feelings about the Trump administration, should condemn violence against federal officers and the destruction of federal property. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your listing for me the areas of concern in your opening statement, and I'm looking forward to addressing them all.
You know, it's telling it happens in our studio. It happens on remote broadcast. It obviously happens in Washington. Even if you whisper, if you have a live mic there, you're whispering in front of, it amplifies the sound. People can hear it. Just let it point that out to the tech ops there. So we'll come right back, get your reaction to just the opening statements in today's long-ranging House Judiciary Committee hearing with Attorney General William Barr. Be right back.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
Yeah, and also check in our text line at that number, Jesse and Grant. Yeah, the ring in the background of that. You think they could do a little better than that in Washington? You know, I give them hell in Montgomery, the bad audio that comes out of the pressers up there. But here we are. I mean, this is. This is the House Judiciary Committee going on here, and they couldn't get the audio right. Let's do this, though. Let's jump forward as we did the opening statements to kind of set things up. I want to go in real time now to what's going on as it continues in Washington, and we have Debbie Lesko out of Arizona, from Republican out of Arizona, speaking right now, and William Barr about to answer. Dalton, let's go to that audio live.
Constituted authority of the government. They're also, to me, outrageous because the people who are living now under this autonomous zone haven't selected the government. They've selected the duly authorized government of the city and the state. So it's quite an outrage that people would use force to take over an area. What makes me concerned for the country is this is the first time in my memory that the leaders of one of our great two political parties, the Democratic Party, are not coming out and condemning mob violence and the attack on federal courts. Why can't we just say, you know, the violence against federal courts has to stop? Could we hear something like that?
Mr. Attorney General, I totally agree. I support what you're doing, and I support what President Trump is doing for law and order in our country, and I yield back.
The gentlelady yields back. The committee will stand in recess for 5 minutes.
The wrap-up on that portion. And coming back next hour, we'll be talking about this, I'm sure, later on in the show next hour and coming up tomorrow. But they're probably, I don't know, the way it's been going, I expect another couple hours of this going into the afternoon. Once again, this was set up as a hearing into the Roger Stone sentencing, and it's gone a lot of different places since then. All right, coming up next hour, State Senator Chris Elliott joins us. Also, after the top of the hour news, Katrina Pearson, senior advisor for the Trump campaign, joins us. We'll talk with her about a whole slew of things, and if you got specific questions on strategy for President Trump's campaign, I got somebody on who can maybe answer those. So you can text those in to 343-0106, 343-0106. Also, a couple other notes here before we get to the news. Dalton, I mean, I heard the news update from WKRG saying that the protest happened, you know, before the city council meeting today. Did you see anything that showed, like, how many people showed up at this protest? Was it, once again, this is the protest because they're asking for the policies and procedures, basically, for MPD. And did you see the numbers for people there?
I saw at 9 o'clock on our news station partners at WKRG, Chad Petrie for sure showed up at the protest. Now, he was there too.
Were there more members of the media than there were protesters?
At least initially, that's how it appeared. I know in the one of the windows of Government Plaza, and Mr. Petrie was standing right there next to Government Plaza where this protest was supposed to occur. I saw one person in the reflection, unless he was on the complete, you know, opposite side or standing completely away from the protesters, at least initially. And I do think that 9 a.m. was the scheduled time for this protest. I didn't see many out there. I have to admit, I did not check back in later to see if maybe more people showed up.
I didn't see any either. That's why I was asking if you saw something early, because I checked later and I didn't see a whole bunch of people, you know. And that's one of the things that can get lost. People can say, oh, well, there was a protest today. There was a slated protest. Well, that can make you think, oh, there's all these people there. And sometimes just because you say you're having a protest doesn't mean there's going to be a lot of people there. Just
means
you've slated a protest. So I really want to know the number, you know, the number of people.
And we've seen that plenty of times before on both sides. You know, whether you're arguing a right-wing issue or a left-wing issue, all this big hubbub comes out. And usually, you know, press releases are sent out. Of course, the media covers it. That's their job. But you hear so much about these different protests going in. And then, you know, you actually need people that believe in that cause. And I'm not saying there aren't people that believe in that cause, but it's got to be something that really stirs the emotion and gets people to show up to the protest.
Well, because people are at work. It's the same reason there's not – I mean, like you said, it works on both sides here. I mean, it's one of the reasons why you don't have a whole bunch of people at the city council meetings. You know, often they'll have, not often, but a couple times a year, they'll have these, like, after hours or 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon city council meetings, and then go, wow, look at all these people who showed up. Yeah, because they can. They didn't have to be at work. Same thing with protests. I don't know how many people wanted to protest this or not, but you have a protest at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday morning. That's like capital W work time. It's a Tuesday.
Yeah.
Tuesday has to be the workiest day. I mean, I know some of my friends have worked shift work, but Tuesday's like the day. That's the workiest. Tuesday and Wednesday are the workiest of the work days, and 9 in the morning is the most worky of the work times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you're going to have some kind of protest, you want to get a bunch of people there. 9 o'clock on Tuesday is probably not your time.
Yeah, give me after 5 p.m., maybe a Saturday. I'm all right if you sprinkle in a Sunday protest. I might show up to that, but I'm not sure how many employers around here use that as an excused absence. Hey, boss, I need to take off today and go to a protest. I know there's been other cities here recently that have made that argument that you should be allowed out.
Not Mobile.
No, we're definitely a working city. I've got to check and see exactly what those numbers ended up being for today's protest. I will say firsthand, looking at the, at least early on, right after 9 a.m., I did not see, anyone out there for this protest.
Right. And that's kind of that's why I was double checking, because that's kind of what I saw. And also, too, nothing has changed since yesterday, but I mean, other than the traffic on our Facebook page and the story about the ABC board voting to restrict alcohol sale hours at restaurants and bars. By the way, they left it open-ended, although they said in that meeting yesterday they didn't want it to go on for too long. But this idea that somehow we're going to affect change here on coronavirus by shutting down alcohol sales at 11, not 10, not 9, not midnight, at 11 p.m., shutting down the alcohol sales. You have 30 minutes then to drink your alcohol, and then you can stay at the bar or restaurant. You just can't have any booze. So,
yeah.
And they said at some point in the meeting yesterday that alcohol reduces inhibitions. Okay. This is what gets me. I understand the spirit. I want to do the things that make sense to try to limit the spread of coronavirus as well. But if somebody goes out to the bar or restaurant where they already can not wear a mask, right, because you're eating or drinking, they already can not wear a mask. They go in there, and they've been drinking since whatever, 7. I don't know. They've been drinking. But now at 11, you're going to stop the booze, but they can stay in the place what have you changed?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess maybe they think, well, they cut the booze off and people will leave. Then just shut the place down then, if that's what you want to have happen.
Yeah.
Versus telling people that they can sit in there, but they can't drink in the bar and restaurant after 11:30.
Yeah, and meme of the day was sent to us earlier during the morning show. I think Grant sent it to us. And you're going to crush me on this, my movie knowledge for some of these movies. I don't think I've ever seen Gremlins, but I kind of get the gist.
Oh, my gosh, what's wrong with you?
I shouldn't have even brought it up, but I get the gist, right? And it looks like... the small cuddly creature. I don't know if it becomes a gremlin.
That's the Mogwai. That's the Mogwai.
Okay.
That's the Mogwai. You don't get the Mogwai wet or after, 11 o'clock or whatever, because then it turns into a gremlin.
Exactly right. You're comparing it to the alcohol sales situation right here.
Well, there you go. Maybe the ABC board used the movie Gremlins, the 80s classic movie Gremlins, to make their decision. Quite possible. All right, coming up next, Katrina Pearson with the Trump campaign right here on Midday Mobile.